But a very good evening to all of you ladies and gentlemen, and for this esteemed opportunity to have you all here when Sikyong Central Supreme Administration in Dharamshala is very much emphasized. Most of you may be knowing, and many may also not be knowing, but I am known by the name O.P. Tandon, and I am one of the founding trustees of the Foundation for Nonviolent Alternatives, short form, we call it FNBA. Well, on behalf of the Foundation, I extend our heartfelt thanks to the Honorable Sikyong, Mr. Penpasheri, for graciously accepting our invitation to speak this evening. I am also grateful to General Ashok Mehta for chairing this program and to Dr. Sujit Kumar, the former convener of the All Party India Parliamentary Forum for Tibet. This occasion today presents a remarkable opportunity to gain first-hand insights from Tibet's political leader, the Sikyong, regarding the current situation in the light of the Resolve Tibet Act, future strategies for Tibet, and the enduring legacy of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. A discourse delivered directly by the Sikyong will undoubtedly place the Tibetan narrative in its rightful context, dispelling Chinese misinformation and disinformation that arises periodically. Additionally, I will request the Honorable Sikyong to outline a pathway for how the Central Tibetan Administration believes the Government of India can assist, especially considering the challenging circumstances we shall face in the future. Furthermore, keeping today's audience in mind, it would be beneficial that the Honorable Sikyong would also provide his insights on how the CTF future strategy and India's strategic concerns could or can merge. I would like to introduce General Ashok Mehta to you. General Mehta was commissioned in 1957. He joined the 5th Gorkha Rifles former fort and is one of the two officers who attended both the Command and the General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, US, and the Royal College of Defence Studies, UK. He is a founder member of Defence Planning Staff, and his last assignment was General Officer Commanding IPKF, South Sri Lanka. General Mehta has fought in every war and counterinsurgency operations between 1957 and 1991, except the 62 war when he was on a peacekeeping mission in Congo. These include 65 India-Pakistan war, 1971 India-Pakistan war both in East and West Pakistan, Indian peacekeeping forces Sri Lanka, and several tenures fighting CIS in northeastern Kashmir. After his retirement, although I don't see that he has retired, as an independent security analyst, General Mehta has been involved in a number of Track 1 and Track 2 dialogues and peace processes, India-Pakistan, India-Sri Lanka, India-Nepal, and a trilateral India, Pakistan, Afghanistan. He has written and spoken about recent India-China clashes in Ladakh and Indo-Pacific. He has been involved in back-channel dialogue on behalf of the government in Nepal and Sri Lanka. Lastly, I would like to briefly introduce the Foundation. FNBA is a not-for-profit and a non-partisan organization focused on the geopolitical and the strategic significance of developments in Tibet and China from an Indian policy perspective. Our main focus, therefore, is Tibet and by extension China, East Turkestan, Southern Mongolia, and of course the Himalayan states of India. We are confident that this program will pave the way for future initiatives and expanded collaborations with the week. Well, in the morning we are meeting at Vivekananda Foundation on matters concerning Tibet. May I now request General Mehta to take command of the...
Yeah, that's a very good word, command. I first of all must thank Mr. Tandon, the founder of FNBA, which has done sterling work for the cause of Tibet. And I've been associated with FNBA for at least, it should now be 2 decades. And it's been a great honor, a relearning about Tibet. But today, Mr. Tandon has bestowed the biggest honor that a retired general can claim. I am chairing a session where a serving Sikyong, the Prime Minister or Chief Minister of a democratically elected free Tibet is sitting on my left. And that is a supreme honor because I have chaired many sessions but never with a serving Prime Minister. So I was going to request you to put your hands together and give the Sikyong a thumping. Now my job otherwise would have been to crack a few light-hearted anecdotes, but in deference to time, and everybody tells me in the air there is flu, so we don't want to spread flu. But the other flu is even more dangerous, which is about what I just heard about the rapprochement between India and China. And you take it from me, I am no fortune teller, but I have studied the problem for a long time. This is some diplomatic garnishing that you see before the BRIC summit, so that she and Narendra Modi Prime Minister can meet. And I can give it to you here in writing that the Chinese will not restore status quo ante as of 20th April 2020, which is our bottom line. So we can settle for patrolling arrangements, and I'll speak about this tomorrow if we have the opportunity in our strategy session. But right now I just want to leave it there that this is a matter of very grave concern to India. The Sikyong, as I mentioned to you, is an elected leader, and he has been part of the parliament for almost a decade, and then he went away to the United States to represent His Holiness the Dalai Lama in interacting with the Congress, US think tanks, and various other bodies. And then he was elected as the Sikyong. And the next elections for the Sikyong are to be held in 2026, I understand. But he speaks excellent Tamil, he speaks very good Hindi, and he is a kind of a linguist. And so let's welcome this great man to the session. Our first speaker is going to be Mr. Sujit Kumar, who is sitting there on the left. Sujit Kumar is a member of the Honorable Sujit Kumar is a member of the Rajya Sabha, member of the Standing Committee on Home Affairs, on Consultative Committee, External Affairs, Press Council of India, and the Indian Council for World Affairs. So that's a great deal. He's a lawyer. He practices in the Supreme Court while he's not in Parliament. And he was a member, if not the chair, of the Parliamentary Forum on Tibet. Is that correct?
I was the convener.
We will start this evening's proceedings by Mr. Sujit Kumar speaking to us very briefly, after which we will have the sikyong. And Honorable Sujit Kumar tell us more about the activities of the Parliamentary Forum on Tibet, because that's what everybody here is gathered for. So you have an excellent menu for this evening, and we are starting with the Dr. Sujit Kumar.
Good evening, Pasidelek. Thank you, General Mehta. Some slight corrections. I am no longer available. I resigned from the parliament last month. I had to, because I changed my political party, and because of anti-defection law, I had to quit my membership of the parliament. So I am no longer a member of parliament. Secondly, I am not even a doctor. Neither am I a medical doctor, nor do I have a PhD. So I am ordinary Sujit Kumar, not Dr. Sujit Kumar. But nevertheless, thank you for the introduction. Thank you, Mr. Tandon, and FNVA. I've known Dr. Tandon, Mr. Tandon, and his team for a while now, because of our common interests in issues pertaining to Tibet. And thanks for the invite. I'll be very, very brief, because we are all assembled here to hear the sikyong. And his deep insights is something which will be invaluable for all of us. So I'll not take more than a few minutes. The All-Party Parliamentary Forum on Tibet, it's a non-statutory body, meaning that it doesn't have the official sanction of the Indian government or the parliament. But it was started by late M.C. Chagla, if some of you might have heard of him, doyen of Indian legal field and a great man. Subsequently, some great leaders as Atal Bihari Vajpayee ji, George Fernandez Saab, Yashwant Sinha, people of that stature have led the forum, and I had I'm extremely humbled to say that the forum was sort of defunct for a while, and then we revived it in 2021, and I was chosen as the convener, the national convener. And we, so because I resigned from parliament, or rather because I had decided to resign from parliament, I also left my convenership of the forum, and now Mr. Bhaturi Mehta, member of parliament from Odisha, a very senior member of parliament, six-time member of parliament from Odisha, is now the new convener. The idea when the All-Party Parliamentary Forum on Tibet started, the idea was to raise issues of Tibet within the Indian parliament and outside the parliament, and also to make fellow MPs understand about the issue, because Tibet is not an internal issue of China. Tibet, as we all hear, would agree probably, is our northern border to the east. It's not China. We never used the India-China border. I have never used India-China border, and in fact, in the parliament also, on multiple occasions, I have spoken on the issue of Tibet on the floor of the house, and I always maintained that is the India-Tibet border. So, the idea of the forum was to raise issues pertaining to Tibet or pertaining to Tibetans living in India. We have a large diaspora of our Tibetan brothers and sisters, about 80,000 Sikhs, if not
72, 73.
Okay, so that's a sizable diaspora, and they live in many states, in different camps, communities, and they have some issues. They don't have issues with the local population. I mean, there are issues which concerns them with regards to the respective state governments, with regards to government of India. So the forum also tries to raise these issues with the state governments, with government of India, or with the district administration, and tries to resolve them. More importantly, we want to keep the issue alive. We believe that increasingly, the younger lord of India are not very conversant about the issue, and particularly if you talk to university students, if you talk to even politicians, most of them would not understand what the issue of Tibet is. Most of them would believe or would say that it's something which is internal to China, and China has been very cunningly successful in selling this narrative that Tibet, you know, don't talk about Tibet. Your government follows the one China policy. China, what's happening in Tibet is the internal of China. Everything is hunky-dory in China, in Tibet. And I had the good fortune of visiting Tibet in 2009. And this was 15 years ago. And I can tell you from first-hand personal experience, I don't know how many of in this room have been to Tibet, that even back in 2009, the kind of genocide that I saw myself, cultural genocide, and China being hell-bent on destroying the Tibetan identity, the Tibetan way of life, this was 2009, and it's 100 times worse today. So, this most Indians do not know. So, one of the primary objectives of the forum is to keep the issue alive, to raise these issues, to highlight these issues within the Indian population, particularly in the policy making circle. Right. And for this, during every parliament session, we strive to have at least one meeting of fellow MPs. There were about 15 to 20 MPs who were part of this forum. Some very senior names like Srimati Manika Gandhi, Jayaram Ramesh, Rajiv Chandrasekhar, until he was a minister, so on and so forth. So it's a multi-party body. We have members from pretty much every major political party of the country, from different states. So yeah, these are the primary objectives of the forum. And I'm glad that Mr. Mehtab, who is a very seasoned politician and a very wise man, is now the new convener. Thank you.
Can I, with Sikyong, your permission, since he has to leave, just take one or two questions?
Sure.
Yeah. I'm here for the next 40 minutes.
So, on this parliamentary forum, which is revived in 2021, if you want to ask any questions, please do. Okay. Be brief in your question.
Can I just, General Mehta, with your permission,
yes.
I will forward to add something. One of the key objective of the forum, the parliamentary forum, is to urge government of India to honor His Holiness with the highest civilian award of our country, that's the Bharat Ratna. Because we truly believe that if today anyone in the country amply deserves the Bharat Ratna, it's His Holiness, who is a real Ratna of India. So we have started the signature campaign. We have signatures of about 80 MPs now. Dr. Sashi Tharoor is one of the senior leaders who is leading this cause, and we want to urge Honorable Prime Minister to consider this.
Right.
Thank you. Now we can take one or two questions. Then I use my prerogative as the chair to ask you why has there been no debate in Parliament? You know, your deliberations are in-house and they don't even get reported by the media. So, what is the use of the parliamentary forum if the issue is to be kept alive? Then something must happen about spreading the word.
To completely agree with you, General Mehta, it's untrue that there are no debates where debate is not highlighted. Yeah. The debates are far and few, and that is because the Indian government is extremely diffident when it comes to Tibet. I mean, it's almost like Tibet is a word which they don't want to use. And I have submitted a private member bill. I had submitted a private member bill called the Tibet Policy Bill 2022. So every member of parliament is entitled to submit what we call a private member bill. Okay. When a member of parliament feels that the government is not doing enough to legislate on a particular area, then the member can submit what is called a private member bill. And then you have to introduce what is called a private member bill. And then some of the bills are taken now for discussion. It's very, very unlikely for a private member bill to become an act. The last time a private member bill became law was in 1974. The closest in recent times, the closest any private member bill came to be legislated was in 2014 when Mr. Tiruchi Siva, member of parliament from DMK Tamil Nadu, submitted a private member bill called the Transgenders Bill. That was passed in the Rajya Sabha but could not pass in Lok Sabha, and hence it did not become an act. My idea was, I knew that this bill would never pass, the majority in both the houses. But the idea was to highlight the issue. So, I was requested by MEA to withdraw the bill. So, I can understand. And the reason that was given to me was that, you know, border negotiations are going on with China. So, this is not the opportune time to have the Indian Parliament discuss a bill like this. So kindly withdraw this bill in national interest. So when they used this word national interest, I had to yield. I said, if you feel that this withdrawal is going to be national interest, then I'm certainly going to withdraw it. Of course, I didn't have to because they couldn't force me. As a member of parliament, it was my right to have my bill introduced. But because MEA urged me, I had to withdraw it. There have been some instances, I mean, for instance, when we speak on budget, you know, I try to give the Tibet angle, saying that, you know, we need to support Tibet institutions in India. Last year, I think there was a budget cut, so I very, very strongly raised about it. I got a few other MPs from Lok Sabha to also raise this. Why are there budget cuts on Tibetan institutions? Then when we talk of defense budget, we bring in the Tibet angle and, you know, all this. So, yes, I completely agree with you, General Mehta, that, you know, we need to speak more on Tibet in the Indian Parliament so that it's reported in the media. But, you know, the reality, I have just told you what reality is. But let me assure you that, you know, going forward, that will be one of the key objectives of the forum. And without this also, I think there's a lot of utility of the forum. You know, the fact that, you know, we have more MPs, you know, at least 15 or 20 MPs, some of them very senior MPs, respected names in Indian politics, come in and interact with the Tibetan MPs, you know, and the speaker, oftentimes the speaker of the Tibetan community themselves joins Sikyong, I think you may have joined once before. So that itself lends credibility to the forum and media reports on it.
Right, thank you very much.
A question to.
Yeah, very brief. Very brief.
Thank you, Chair, very much. I wanted to ask, since you brought up the question of Tibetan Bharat Ratna to His Holiness, the policy of Indian government, I believe, after the Tibetan came and settled is to keep the Tibetan society in separate development programs and not to let them amalgamate within the Indian society. Now, was it because it was beneficial for Tibetans, or it was our policy not to let them have it, or we were worried about not upsetting China? What was the thing? Because I personally feel they should have been allowed to assimilate within our society. So what was this reason for this particular?
I think there's a mixture of all of this, but I believe Sikyong will be better placed to answer this. But one of the reasons was that when in 1959 Solinus came, and then in the subsequent years, thousands of his followers started pouring into India. Didn't Prime Minister Nehru wrote to almost all, I think he wrote to all the chief ministers to requesting to allocate land for the Tibetan settlements. And some of the chief ministers responded, Niji Lingappa in Karnataka, Biju Patnaik in Odisha, and some others. There was no coherent policy per se. Government of India, I think, in 1950s and 60s didn't have a single policy as to how the settlements will operate. But I think it's one community which has never had any issue with any of the locals. I'm astounded by the fact that 60 plus years of living in India, 65 years almost, but never had minor hiccups maybe. Never had an issue with the locals. That is a great tribute to the community. And I would like to place it on record, our appreciation secure to your, to our brothers and sisters, Tibetan brothers and sisters, how they have lived peacefully in India.
Thank you very much. And now, you've all been waiting for the Sikyong, and the floor is yours, Your Excellency.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairman Mehta. I have a slight cold, so my voice is a little different today. And thank you, FNPA, for this opportunity. And to follow up on Chairman Mehta's question, or your question rather, on why Tibetans are not assimilated with the Indian community here. In the initial stage when we came here, we were going through very difficult times, and Pandit Nehru was the one who suggested that if you want to maintain your identity, then it'll be best to provide education to Tibetan children. So as and when we started compact communities now that are available, and Tibetans are spread across 10 different states and 2 union territories, since 37 locations all around India, we were settled into compact communities, because of which we managed to preserve our identity in terms of the government of India starting schools specifically for Tibetans to study Tibetan language alongside other subjects that we need to follow under CBSE curriculum. So we managed to re-establish our monastic institutions, which were destroyed in Tibet by the Chinese, and we also managed to re-establish many of our cultural institutions. So we have, in a way, been very successful in preserving and promoting our religion and culture within the exact community. So this is just to tell you why Tibetans were not assimilated. If Tibetans are assimilated with the Indian community, then perhaps today you won't find any Tibetan who speaks Tibetan language in its entirety. So, we have a small piece for, we have very senior people like General Vinod Sehgal, our friends Obi Tenton, Ron Banerjee, Chairman Mehta, and Sujitji has been with us now for the last several years, and we were in Forum 2000 in Czech Republic together. We came back together. We lost our baggage together. He was in Dubai, and he had to buy a suit and all the dresses for himself. And when I was traveling from here to Germany, my baggage got left behind in Delhi. So I had to buy clothes for myself, or rather my friends bought it for me. So we had similar experiences. He has been very active in the Inter-Parliamentary Alliance on China, which is a new body composing of many members of parliament from different parts of the world coming together to work, not in favor, but when it, the name sounds like in favor of China, Alliance on China, but they do everything against Chinese government. And it's quite a powerful body where they are focusing on Taiwan right now on the UN resolution of 2758, trying to reverse what China's interpretation of the 2758 UN resolution is all about on Taiwan. So since there are many who are from the younger generation, we sometimes live under the illusion that Indians know about Tibet. Since we've lived here for the last 65 years, we believe that Indians should know about Tibet, but unfortunately that is not the case. FNB also helped organize a talk for us at Symbiosis University in Pune, and we have been doing these rounds also. I've been speaking to universities in England, in Oxford, in Westminster, in Aberdeen University, and also the Warwick Economic Summit. And we will cover more universities in the times to come, perhaps next year in India. So I normally start with the basic questions. Where people don't know the basics. Then we talk about very high-level issues, which are not maybe not so relevant if you don't understand the basics. So we start. I start by talking about the global significance of Tibet. Now, for some, you might have a very blur idea of what Tibet is all about. For some, you may definitely be knowing much more. But for those of you who have a very blur image of Tibet, I start with this map. It's a satellite image. It's not written by hand, so you know how Tibetan plateau is placed in this. There are several plateaus in this world, but the highest plateau is the Tibetan plateau. And we ourselves, in our prayers, we say Kangri Rabe Kowe Shingam Chong. In the next slide, you will see the Tibetan version. Kangri Rabe Shingam Chong is Shingam. There is the first line when we pray for the long life of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. We call ourselves Kangchenpa, people who live in the snows. And this means it's the heavenly abode surrounded by snow mountain ranges. And now, how it is not surrounded by snow mountain ranges? You have the Himalayas in the south, you have the Karakoram in the west, the Kunlun in the north, and series of mountain ranges in the east. So Tibet is surrounded by snow mountain ranges. That's how we define ourselves. And then you have the Western scholars who started, Westerners, mostly missionaries, Jesuits, who crossed over Tibet in the late 16th century, and from 17th century, the Christian missionaries considered Tibet as the last frontier where Christianity could not penetrate. So they have been trying to come into Tibet from different directions, from the west, from Ladakh area, from south, from east, from north, everywhere. And we can count the number of peoples who have been to Tibet. Since 17th century, Christian missionaries started coming into Tibet. They started the first churches in Tibet, in Saparong, in Kuge, and also in Shigeze in the 17th century. Then there were also the Jesuits and also Capuchins who came to Tibet in the early 18th century, in 1705, lasting up to 1743. And there are a lot of stories about Desideri, Ippolito Desideri, and the Capuchins as to who has the right to spread Christianity in Tibet. This case went on for very long, even after the death of Ippolito Desideri, who represented the Jesuit community against the Capuchins. I came to know about this much later, only a few years ago, because most of the documents were in Latin, and now it is available in English. So, Westerners, I read one book called Frontier Outpost, written by a Christian missionary who was posted in the China mission on the China-Tibet border. And he named one of his chapter as the roof of the world. Maybe it started from that time or maybe earlier, but that is how the Western world, from this map also you can see how high Tibet is, because Tibet came out of this tectonic shift between the Indian plate and the Eurasian plate, and people still say that the Himalayas is growing by a little thick or 1 millimeter every year, and it's all a seismic zone. So the Westerners refer to Tibet as the roof of the world, and the average elevation is about 4,880 meters. When I was in Japan, I asked the students as to which is the biggest mountain in Japan, and they said Mount Fuji. And how high? 3,700-800 meters. And I said, that's like base camp in Tibet. You start climbing from there. You know, so that's how high, just to give them an imagination of how high Tibet is and how high the Tibetan plateau is. Same condition in New Zealand. Also, the highest mountain is Mount Cook, which is about the same height as Mount Fuji. So the average altitude is about 16,000 feet, according to NASA. It's the highest plateau on Earth, and it's home to the highest mountains in the world, with an area of 2.5 million square kilometers, some say 2.37, out of 9.7 million square kilometers of the total China's landmass. Tibet constitutes about 25% of that landmass. Not many people know about that. One Pakistani journalist asked me once, which is bigger, Bhutan or Tibet? How many times of Bhutan will consist of one China? It's 18 times the size of Japan, 10 times the size of UK, 30 times the size of Austria. So that's how high the Tibet plateau is. So, then, now, today, the Chinese environmental scientists call Tibet as the third pole. Aside from North Pole and South Pole, Tibet has the largest amount of glaciers and permafrost that feeds all these major rivers that flows into 10 different countries in East Asia, Southeast Asia, South Asia. This is just a map to show how you know, the glaciers and permafrost are formed on the plateau that seeks to serve all the rivers that originate from Tibet. And then, of course, today, Tibet is also referred to as the water tower of Asia. So then we talk about this, the environmental significance of Tibet. Let's go into the political significance of Tibet. Just as Sujitji said, Ashok Mehtaji said, there was never ever a border between India and China. Only after the invasion of Tibet by China in 1950, October 5, 1950, starting from Chamdo in the east, became a part of China. And then Tibet has always played the role of a buffer between the two most populous nations in the world. In fact, Tibet, India is not what India was those days. Now, of course, the East India Company and British India rule in India. It's a totally different country, but when we talk about the geographical importance of Tibet, then I also cover the historical part of that, because till 13th century, there was no interference from neighboring countries, and at one time, from between 7th to 9th century, Tibet was a huge empire. We even invaded the capital of China, Xiangyang of today, and also went up to present-day Samarkand in Uzbekistan. That used to be the extent of Tibetan empire at one time. And Tibetan script was also derived. I get asked this question oftentimes because China is now occupied by, Tibet is now occupied by China. So people think that Tibetan language may have something to do with Chinese language, which is not, there is nothing to do with Chinese language. Tibetan script came from the Brahmi and Gupta script in 7th century when King Sonsenghampo sent his minister to Misamoda to invent a Tibetan script, and most likely they went to Kashmir at that time, because Kashmir used to be a hotbed of intellectuals, somewhere you have Islam, Hindu, Buddhist masters converging in that area and have a lot of intellectual discourses, and that is where the Tibetan language comes from. And then the Tibetan Buddhism, today Chinese government like to say that Tibetan Buddhism also came from China. But Buddhism came into China, Tibet, in 8th century, even though it went to China much before that, several centuries before. There were Chinese monks in Tibet, because the Tibetan emperor in 7th century, King Sanzong Ompo, married a Chinese princess and also Nepalese princess, because of which China claims Tibet is a part of China since ancient times, from 7th century onwards, because the Tibetan emperor married a Chinese princess, Wang Chang Ongfu. So in that sense, Nepal can also claim the same over Tibet, you know, because he married a Nepalese princess, Prikuti Devi. If we go another 7-8 centuries before that, there are also stories about the first king of Tibet having come from India. Some say it's Prince Rupati from India. So our connection go back very, very, very far. And Shatrakshita was invited to Tibet, and along with Guru Padma Samava, they established Buddhism in 8th century in Tibet, and this comes directly from India and the Nalanda tradition, which is all that Steve's talking about, based on reason and logic. So it's not a blasphemy to question Buddha's teaching, because you have to use reason for everything. If you are smarter than Buddha, then you can always argue against him. That's also possible. So from 8th to 13th century, we translated, literated almost every available Sanskrit and Pali text into Tibetan. So according to Professor Samdhar Bhushe, we must have had the biggest transliteration house in the world those days. And I keep asking Rinpoche, how can we prove that? And Rinpoche says, it's not our job to prove ourselves, the others will prove for us. So if you are in a better sense, then you can prove that Tibet was or Tibet was not one of the biggest translation literations. So today, all the teachings of Buddha, both in Sanskrit and Pali texts, are available only in the Tibetan language. And some experts, some linguists, I'm not a linguist, I speak a little bit of Tamil and Kannada, Hindi a little bit, but I'm not a linguist. So some linguist on Tibetan language says that Tibetan language is one among the 15 oldest languages in this world. And it's one language that has, we are very proud to be called a repository of one part of ancient Indian wisdom, because of what we did, what our forefathers did in transliterating all the teachings. And today, Tibetan is the only language where you can study Buddhism in its entirety and all its tenets, in the form it should be understood. Even now, it's being translated back into Sanskrit. There are some projects that are going on. So, and recently, we have one monk working along with some 300 scholars had come out with a Tibetan dictionary, which is 233 volumes of dictionary, which has become the most voluminous dictionary in the world in hard copy. So we presented one copy to the Czech National Library. We are going to present another one to the Library of Congress in the United States. They have the largest collection of Tibetan literature, almost 26,000 titles in the Library of Congress alone. So that's how important Tibetan language is also coming from India, Tibetan religion coming from India. So we consider ourselves as an extension of Indian culture. So we feel no different, even most of us now born in India. I keep saying we may look a little different, but our behavior, our way of thinking is everything same as Indians, because our way of thinking is dictated by the spirituality that we believe in. So that part. Then even during those very difficult times between 9th to 13th century, when Tibet disintegrated for about 400 years, we can still hear stories about invasion from the south by Bhaktiyar Khilji. In the beginning of 13th century, 1206, Bhaktiyar Khilji, Khilji's having come to Delhi and then going towards Bengal area, which was then the Kuch Bihar. They sent 10,000 army into Tibet, because Khiljis were also responsible for destroying Kothandapuri and Vikramashila and other Buddhist Nalanda and other institutes. And if they had managed to come into Tibet at that time, I would definitely think that they would have been successful in destroying Buddhism in Tibet as well. But he sent 10,000 people into army into India in 1206, and only 100 returned back, which does not necessarily mean to say that Tibetans killed all the Khilji army, but half of them may have been because they were not used to mortal warfare, and Tibetans duped them into coming a little bit inside and then slammed them from the top, middle and back. And then they had to retreat back, and on their way back, I'm sure there might be Hindu kingdoms also who must have played some role in getting them decimated, reducing them to just 100 soldiers on their way back. So even though Tibet was disintegrated, the frontiers we could see was very strong, even on the Indian border in those days. Then we established relations with the Mongols in 1247. The Sakya leaders, Sakya Pandita Khunga Jansen, then followed by his nephew, Dongbuen Shuye Papa. So they succeeded, and they ruled Tibet for about 100 years when China was invaded by Kublai Khan in 1271. So the period from 1271 to 1368, what the Chinese historians refer to as Yuan Dynasty, is that period when the Mongols ruled China. And we had relations with the Mongols much before. In fact, Tibetan masters were responsible for the Mongolian emperors not to kill Chinese, because they were throwing Chinese into the sea, killing them, and Tibetan masters asked them not to do that. In fact, we have been helping the Chinese for a very long time. I don't understand why we deserve this treatment from the Chinese government today. You know, so Mongols, even today, they say that we were invaders at one time, because 13th century you have Genghis Khan and all his successes. And sometimes there are academic discourses in China as to who is the real Chinese. Is it only the Han Chinese or Mongol Chinese or Tibetan Chinese? If the Mongols are Chinese, then they can claim half of the world, because that is as far as Genghis Khan and his successors went around the world. So you had this period of Mongols ruling China, which is the Yuan Dynasty from 1271 to 1368. Then Mongols were overthrown by the Ming Chinese, who are the real Han Chinese. So they ruled China from 1368 to 1644. In between, in comparative history, we had three dynasties: the Pamutuba Dynasty, Rimpumba Dynasty, and Devasangpa Dynasty for about 300 years. And the fifth Dalai Lama took over the temporal and spiritual leadership of Tibet in 1642. 2 years before the Mings, or the Manchus, or the Qings, sorry, Qings, the Manchus, overthrew the Mings in China. So the societal perspective of the Chinese people is that the Manchus are not Chinese. If you watch Kung Fu movies, you will see that all the protagonists are Chinese, and all the antagonists, all the Dakus, are Manchus. So that perspective is also there. I think someone already mentioned about in Manchuria now, there's hardly anybody who speaks the Manchukuo language, because they rule China from Beijing, from China itself. And then you have the Manchus who ruled from 1644 to 1911, and Dalai Lama, the successive Dalai Lamas, have been ruling Tibet. And there has never ever been another foreign country who have directly ruled Tibet. Influence has always been there. If you look at a history of any other country in this world, there would be influences by neighbors. It's natural. You cannot stay in isolation by ourselves, even though we lived on those mountains and lived in isolation, because of which we could not get the interest of the international community when needed. So this is just to give a brief history, because some Indians also say, well, Tibet became independent from 1913-14, where the 13th Dalai Lama had to flee Tibet in 1910 and lived in India for 2 years before going back to Tibet. And by that time, we removed every single Chinese from Tibet in 1912. Well, that was also the end of the Qing Empire, so at the beginning of the nationalist movement. Now, when we travel around the world, we keep telling, of course, we are very committed to the middle way policy. Of course, we can talk about that later. Speaking about the geostrategic importance of Tibet, we believe that if the Sino-Tibetan dispute can be resolved peacefully through the middle way approach, non-violent approach, negotiated solution, and also mutually beneficial, that would be lasting. As we speak, we are talking about 55 violent conflicts going on around this world, and the message of peace is very, very relevant. So this is one part. Then, of course, we can talk about the the environmental importance of Tibet. If you go to the next slide, you can also see that the rivers that originate from Tibet go into China. The Yellow River in the east is cradle to Chinese civilization. And then you also have the Yangtze that's going to the south of China. Without these two rivers, which are the lifelines of China, China cannot support its 1.4 billion people. And now there are serious attempts by the Chinese government to divert rivers from Tibet into northern China, which is getting parched. And with a lot more industrialization going on, there's a lot more pollution of water in China, and they need more water. And then you also have the Mekong that flows into five different countries in Southeast Asian countries. In Southeast Asia, you have Laos, Burma, Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam. You know, all these five countries. Now, if you go to these regions and read news, you will hear about a lot of stories of people's livelihood being changed. Because China does not share hydrological data with any of its downstream countries. Forget about water sharing. So they use Tibet's water like a water tap. If there is excess, they let it flow, then the downstream countries have flood. If they have shortage, they let it cut it off, and then you have drought in the downstream countries. Then you also talk about two other rivers, Sabine and Irrawaddy, that flows into Burma. Then the Tsangpo or the Brahmaputra. Tsangpo is the Tibetan name for Brahmaputra before it flows into India. It starts from Western Tibet, comes to Eastern Tibet, takes a U-turn to go into India. And 2 years back, I was in Arunachal Pradesh, and of course, with Pema Khandu, Chief Minister, giving us state guest status, he lent us helicopters to travel. And the helicopter, we were taken over the Brahmaputra from Meo settlement to Tuting settlement, which is very close to the border in Geni, in Arunachal Pradesh, in eastern Arunachal Pradesh. We were taken over the Brahmaputra, and we could see that Brahmaputra was very, it's tea color. It's polluted. When you see from the helicopter, you can see the tributaries that join the Brahmaputra was pristine clear. And actually the river that should be coming out of Tibet also should be pristine clear. There was no rain happening. It was not rainy season, but the river was still muddy. And the locals tell me that it was not happening in the last 1-2 years. It has been happening since 2018, which means to say that there's a lot of work going on at this place called the Great Bend in Pemakwe, where they are building a mega dam twice the size of Three Gorges, which is the biggest in the world. And we talked about this whole Himalayan range being a seismic zone. And if something happens to that size of a dam inside Tibet, you know, you can imagine how much land and flora and fauna that are very unique to Tibet. It's going to be inundated upstream. And then if something happens to that side of the time, what will happen to people in Arunachal Pradesh, in the plains of Assam, even when there is no outlet by the Chinese? During the rainy season, you always have flood in the region, right? And what will happen to people in Bangladesh? They are all going to be washed away. It's going to have serious catastrophic consequences in the region. Then you also talk about the Ganges originating from the Tibet-India border. Then you also have Anandi that starts from Tibet. We have also seen a major dam that is built on the Kanani by Chinese, which came out beginning of this year. And that flows into Nepal and into India. Then you also have Jhelum and Indus flowing from Tibet into India and then into Bangladesh. And India is also cradle to Chinese, Indus Valley civilization. So the rivers that originate from Tibet provide livelihood to, according to some environmental experts, between 1.8 billion to 2 billion people, out of 8 billion people in the world. So we are now talking about the countries, all the countries that we mentioned, from Pakistan to India, Nepal, Bangladesh, five countries in Southeast Asia, one country in East Asia, China. We are talking about some of the most densely populated areas in this world. So we are not just talking about water sharing, we are talking about serious food security and water security in the region. Some say that Third World War could happen because of water. If that is the case, then Tibet is going to be a huge bio hotspot. But unfortunately, the countries that are surrounding it, China, are not in a position to speak up to the Chinese government. In fact, if you remember, we must have organized the first water conference way back in 2007 in India International Center, when this was not even a topic when I was working for Tibet Parliamentary and Policy Research Center. Now, even now, water is a serious issue. I was speaking at the Constitutional Club one day, one of our old friends who used to work with George Fernandez, he came to me and he asked for my presentation because he needed to study that more. And I thought, if our friend, old friend who used to work for George Fernandez does not know that much, then how much can we expect from other political leaders in the House? You know? But because there are not too many experts on international relations studying about Tibet. Of course, now lately, you see more think tanks coming up, more focus on Tibet, because it's not just the Himalayas that has been the boundary. Now you have the maritime issues with China, starting from Malacca Straits to, you know, having taken over part of Sihanoukville port because Cambodia is not able to pay back the loans, and then having taken over Cocoa Islands and watching India from that vantage point across the Bay of Bengal, and then now having taken over Hambantota port in Sri Lanka, the better relations between President Bijie and China and Maldives, having taken over Gwadar port in Pakistan, which will also be connected by the China-Pakistan economic corridor, which is now between $40 to $60 billion worth of investment in that region. I know the Baluchis are creating some problem for the Chinese there, and that might be an excuse for Chinese to say that we are not able to protect our assets, so we will send in our army. That will be the next step, natural step. And then we all know about the higher than skies, deeper than oceans, sweeter than honey relationship between India and Pakistan. India and China, and then China's diplomatic coup in getting Saudis and the Iranians back on the diplomatic track, their acquirement of the strategic locations in Djibouti, not just in Djibouti, but in other places in Europe as well. Through the Mediterranean also, you see Chinese investments in the ports and seaports and airports and all the infrastructure development that they're involved in. Of course, Italy a bit too, but you still have countries, small countries like Luxembourg, still in the Belt and Road Initiative. So, all this we are quite familiar with. That is why I speak about the environmental importance of Tibet. I'm sure, you know, those environmentalists, they may have a lot more to say, because there are a lot of things that are connected with Tibet's environment which has significant impact on India. Even the weather condition of India, including monsoon, is decided by the jet streams that flow over the Tibetan Plateau. In addition to the El Nino impact of the warming of Pacific, contributes to the depression in India, and then that attracts the clouds, and you know, so how rain also increases in the region. So those are dictated by climatic conditions on Tibet. So it should be of utmost importance for the neighboring countries, not just India, but also downstream countries in Southeast Asia, to reflect on how detrimental Tibet's environmental condition would be for the downstream countries. And the situation in Tibet continues to be very, very, very grave. Sujit Ji mentioned about his visit to Tibet in 2009. That was just 1 year after the large-scale demonstrations that took place in Tibet, participated by people from all walks of life in all the three provinces of Tibet. There was just 1 year after that. I don't know how you managed to get there in 2009. They didn't allow too many people to
come. I was working for an international organization.
Okay. So, since then, of course, now everything is, what Xi Jinping is doing is, where the whole world is moving towards multiculturalism, he's the only one that's moving towards uniculturalism at the expense of language and culture and identity of all other nationalities, including the Tibetans. So in Tibet, people who are in the know must have read about the UN Special Rapporteur's report on the colonial-style boarding schools in Tibet, where more than 1 million or close to 1 million Tibetan children are being forced to go into these boarding schools. Since 2018, they have been asking authorities to close down all the Tibetan schools, private schools. Last 6 months, we have been witnessing more monastic schools being closed, being ordered to close, the eastern part of Tibet, in Kolok area, or in the Kanze area. They are talking about completely doing away with Tibetan language. which is reduced to about 4 classes in a week. In other schools, school libraries have been, all the texts relating to Tibetan literature and Buddhism have been removed from the libraries, except books to do with Tibetan language are kept there as references. And then images of the founder of Tibetan script, Thamisambuddha, and other the literary luminaries are not to be seen at all. So all these memories of past Tibet will be washed away. If this continues for another 10, 15 years down the line, it's going to be very, very consequential for us. And also for Indians, the first thing that I mentioned to a relevant authority was saying this is a huge security threat for India, because Tibetans have a lot of respect for India. We call India the Aryavrat, you know, so the land of the Buddha. And no Tibetan would think of harming India anyway. But if you change the psychology of all the young generations of Tibetans in the next 10, 15 years, they won't have the same emotional quotient with regard to India. That's also going to impact India's security in the long run, not immediately. There is no political space whatsoever. It's more like George Orwell's 1984 coming into reality, where the state surveils and controls everything, including through artificial intelligence. So you have DNA sampling, iris scanning, electronic identification, people being reduced to just a barcode because country is now moneyless in many forms. So whatever you do, whatever you purchase, travel, you do, you are tracked all the time. If General and we were friends, let's say, for during our university days, then if we meet after 20, 30 years right now, the anti-espionage law has gone down to the grassroots. It's more like the SS of East Germany, where everybody is spying on each other. So General has to be very careful about what he tells me about his political thinking, and I have to be very careful about what I burn in paradise. People don't burn themselves in paradise. We had 157 cases of self-emanation from 2009 to about 2-3 years ago. There was one case of Vietnamese Putinist putting himself to death in 63, and it became an international news. Another case in Czech Republic in 68, where there was 157 self-emanations in Tibet. And, you know, these people were driven to the self-determination because most of these people are between the age of 17 to 35. They have never witnessed independent Tibet. They have never witnessed what was destroyed during the Cultural Revolution in terms of monasteries and lives. People lost the loss of lives of people, you know, from 1966 to 1976, during the 10 years of Cultural Revolution. They see only what the Chinese government is doing to Tibet and Tibet people today. These young people are driven to this desperation to burn themselves. It's not like they cannot kill some other Chinese. Of course they can kill, but they don't do it because His Holiness always advised them that if you take up violence, I'm no more responsible for the Tibetan cause. And that's what restrains them. But at the same time, they are driven to this desperation, hoping against hope that the Chinese government will pay some attention to their plight or the international community will come to their rescue, but unfortunately no. So Chinese right now are striking at the very root of our identity, which is related to India. So that is where we feel that India also has a responsibility in voicing their concerns on what is happening inside Tibet, which is not very forthcoming, and which is very, I would at least expect the Indian government to take some position at multilateral forums, if not at bilateral engagements with China, if it is too sensitive a issue. But then at multilateral forums, you have much more leeway. You know, you're working in concert with so many other countries, not necessarily talking about it to the Chinese. So that angle is there. Then we covered the environmental issue. Now we follow what is called as the middle way to find a solution that is non-violent, negotiated, mutually beneficial both for the Chinese people and the Tibetan people. And Chinese government has been putting this precondition on His Holiness the Dalai Lama that His Holiness should say Tibet has been part of China since ancient times, which His Holiness refused to do because he is a Buddhist monk and he cannot lie. So His Holiness always comes with a very wise response saying that I'm not a historian. Let's leave history to historians. And what I mean by middle way is a mutually beneficial solution that is not necessarily focused on victory for oneself, but benefit for everybody, because His Holiness appreciates the concept of European Union. And even now His Holiness says that if it had not been for the concept of European Union, Europeans would still be fighting and killing with each other. right? So if that can be applied to European Union for the larger interests of humanity, then why not Tibet with China, whether we like it or not? We don't have a Hanuman to lift Tibet out of that place and put it somewhere in the Arabian or the Bay of Bengal alongside India. You know, so we can't do that. So whenever we get to go back, we'll have to learn to live in peace with each other. We've lived in peace with each other for centuries with China, with India, now Nepal, Bhutan. Bhutan also came into being from Tibet. Through Tibet, they became a kingdom in the 17th, 18th century. So with this broader, larger, holistic approach in mind, we approached the Sino-Tibet conflict, but we changed our strategy a little bit, because when we say middle, then we are talking about polarities. Without polarities, there is no middle. So the polarities in this case, of course, there could be many polarities in terms of political, economic, a lot of other issues, but strictly in terms of political sense, one polarity we are talking about is the present status of occupied Tibet under the repressive Chinese government. And the other polarity is the historical status of Tibet as an independent state. So if there is no recognition for these polarities, there is no value for middle way. There is no leverage for middle way. It's a very simple fact. You don't need rocket science to discover this. So we started embarking on this new strategy to not just speak about it, but also work with governments to get this status done. So we have been working very closely with the US Congress over the last more than 2 years. And it got stalled for some time because you need consensus from everybody, from the administration as well as both houses of the Congress. And by last year, to November 26th, we got this passed in the U.S. House Foreign Affairs Committee with Michael McCall as the chair and the ranking member, and our friends in the Congress like Jim McAvoy and Speaker Pelosi and all of them coming together. Then we got this move from the House floor by February 15th of this year, with 392 votes out of 431 members present, out of the 435 in U.S. Congress. So we just need a simple two-thirds majority, but this was super majority in the House. And then we got this in the U.S. Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate, quite unanimous in the committee, and also this time we didn't have to piggyback on another legislation to get it passed. Like NDA, which is the biggest legislation in the United States, talks about the National Defense Authorization Act. But this went solo, what they call as hotline. So the hotline is possible when you have consensus of all the leaders, both from the House and the Senate, both the Speaker and the Minority Leader. Then you have Chuck Schumer and McConnell and the Senate. And then you also need the consensus of the chair and the ranking member of both the House Foreign Affairs Committee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, with not one objection from a single senator. So we got this done by June 12th of this year, and got it signed by President Joe Biden on July 12th. Of course, it's a feel-good thing, as Ambassador Kanwar Simulji mentioned this morning. It's a feel-good. We don't take that as a victory. Of course, it's one step forward in our movement and one more instrument in our hands now to reach out to other like-minded countries. Because now the question is, okay, we got the law passed, what next? That's the perennial question. We are waiting. Of course, we are thinking about this, we are strategizing about this, we are discussing with other stakeholders as to what we should be doing, but we are waiting for the US elections to get over, which is 2 weeks from now. And get a sense of who's going to come in the government, because if there's going to be a government change, then we have to work much more. During the last presidency of President Trump, he appointed the special coordinator only on the last year, his fourth year, and that too at the rank of assistant secretary, not undersecretary, because they are also equivalents, you know. Sometimes it's undersecretary, sometimes it's assistant secretary. There are, of course, good side and bad side to all the decisions, but we would prefer that it be at the undersecretary level. So we got this move to the U.S. It's something to celebrate, but not a victory unto itself. It's just one more step in the process. Now we'll have to see how to move forward, whether the US State Department will share some of the responsibilities with us in reaching out to governments or like-minded countries, which they keep talking about, and the people in the Congress. Our good friends there, because we have, fortunately, because of the colonists, we have both bipartisan and bicameral support in the United States. So this is our strategy as of now, and I have four reasons for speaking about the independent, the historical status of Tibet. One is to send a clear message to the Chinese government that the leaders, just on their whims and fancies, cannot distort history, cannot change history, because history is in the past. That is why I keep carrying two books with me these days. One is Michael Van Wolf and Pratt's Tibet Brief 2020, because he looked at the history of Tibet from an international legal perspective. And he proves, because the reason why I mentioned the Yuan and the Ming and Qin is to get a perspective of comparative history between India, between China and Tibet. In Michael's book, whether it's Tibet-Yuan relation or Tibet-Ming relation or Tibet-Qing relation, or as per international law today, Tibet has never been considered part of China. That he worked with more than 100 scholars from around Central Asia, not just with Tibetan scholars, and proves this fact based on international law. The other book is by a Chinese professor called Professor Lau Hanshan. He's based in Las Vegas, in LA these days. But he was a Chinese professor. When he was in his university days, he used to be perturbed by this question as to why is Chinese government asking every government to say Tibet is part of China or Tibet is part of PRC. If the claim of China that Tibet has been part of China since ancient times is true, then why do Chinese government have to ask every government to say Tibet is part of PRC? So that intrigue instilled in him a commitment to work on the history of Tibet. So after he finished his, he retired from his job as a professor, he went on the Communist Party website and he downloaded all the imperial Chinese historical records from the Communist Party website. And now he has come out with a book in Chinese, which should be available in English version in the next 2-3 months. It's going to be two-volume book. It's not written in a historical format. It's written in the format as an argument as to how China, Tibet is not part of China, from the perspective of imperial Chinese historical records. So it's in old Chinese, and he took a lot of time to write that book. He came out with these two books based on Ming and Qing China. Now he'll be working on Yuan and nationalist movement and communist China as to how they redefine Tibet. So he proves that if you can consider the Manchus and Mongols also as Chinese, then they have never considered, Imperial China has never considered Tibet as part of China. So these two books are powerful. And then you also have Ambassador Dalip Mehta, written about the Imperial Games in Tibet. You have Nirupama Rao, former Secretary MEA, written about Fractured Himalayas. So you have a lot more writings coming up in Tibet, which are not from Tibetan origin. But I have not carried the Tibetan books if this could be considered propaganda or bias in some sense. So we, based on what His Holiness' response was, you know, so now when I travel around, I tell countries that if you keep repeating the statement that Tibet is part of PRC, you're going against international law. Because whether it's happening to Ukraine today or it happened to Tibet 74 years ago, it was and it is the same international law. There are no two international laws. So aggression on China, on Tibet, by the Chinese Communist Party, the People's Liberation Army, and the forceful using force for the Tibetans to sign the 17-point agreement. These are the two things that we mentioned. These are illegal. This should be null and void under international law because this was under duress. So if that is the case, then it should be the same as what is happening to Ukraine today. It should be considered the same case. And then we tell governments also that on the one hand, they keep repeating the statement that Tibet is part of PRC. On the other hand, they keep saying we appreciate or we encourage negotiation between representative of Islam, the Dalai Lama and the Chinese government. Now I keep telling them, you are contradicting yourself. You are removing the very ground for negotiation when every country keeps repeating the statement like a parrot at the behest of the Chinese government that Tibet is part of PRC, then where is the reason for China to come and talk to us? You know, So they are contradicting themselves. I bring that forth to the foreign officers. Then the third thing we tell them is, why do you think Chinese government is asking every government to say Tibet is part of PRC? Why not Uyghur? Why not Mongolia? Why not Manchuria? That is because the Chinese government knows that they have no legitimacy of their rule in Tibet, and they are trying to seek that legitimacy from the international community. So now, if the international community gives recognition to this, then they are complicit with China in what China is doing, you know, to Tibet. So with this argument, I reach out to the international community. Of course, every country, we have been also very pragmatic in our approach that if there has to be a middle way solution, there is no other way than by reaching out to the Chinese government. It's the truth, it's a fact. And then the other thing is, till such a time, we will have to reach out to the international community. But we don't expect the international community to leave aside their national interest for the interests of Tibet. Now, our task is, how do we align our interests with the interests of that nation so that we can gain some traction in the support of these countries. So I keep talking not only about politics, not only about Tibet. We talk about Uyghur, Mongolia, Manchus, Hong Kongers, Taiwanese, pro-democracy leaders within China. We tell governments, please don't look at us only as victims of communist China. If you can look at us as partners for bringing about positive change in China. Nobody wants anarchy in China, because China is today the second largest economy in the world. It's going to have serious consequences all over the world. But if we want positive changes in China and Tibet, then you need both internal forces and external forces. Whether we agree or not, Tibetans are Tibetans alongside Mongols, Manchus, the Uyghurs, Hong Kongers, pro-democracy leaders, even Taiwanese for that matter, are the internal forces. And combined with external forces, then we can bring about positive changes. Just like we have the Special Coordinator's Office in the United States based on this law, because the U.S. is the only country that has a law on Tibet from 2002, called the Tibet Policy Act of 2002, which has now been amended through the Tibet Supported Policy Act of 2020 that added the element of His Holiness reincarnation. I'm sure this will be a topic tonight also, just as it is everywhere. Everywhere we go, it's about His Holiness and His Holiness reincarnation, and what next and all that. So this is how we are trying to reach out, and we also tell the Europeans, because Europeans need to wake up. If they don't wake up, what Chinese government is doing to Europeans is exactly what the colonials used to use against the colonies of divide and rule, carrot and stick. They play the same game against the Europeans because they don't have a common trade policy or a common foreign policy, which we have been asking them to have. Now with the tariff on EV vehicles, the commissions in the EU are a little more active, and because that's the prerogative of the commission, not the national governments, to impose tariff on imports from China. Now it's been up to 17 to 34%, over and above 10% on any import from China. But we keep telling them, we keep reminding them that, and some of my friends in Japan and in Europe say that, oh, the dragon is biting at us. And I tell them, dragon at one point was very weak. Who fed the dragon to make it so strong to be able to bite at you? It's the United States. You don't have to read 2 minute books, just read one book, Kissinger on China. That's enough to understand how much US has played a role in, you know, supporting or China, whenever it was about to fall down. Then you have the European Union with all this investment, and that's also because Germany is going the other way around when it comes to tariff on Chinese EV cars. It's going to kill their market, their production centers, the automotive industry in Germany. But still, they like to promote a laissez-faire, a free market economy, not to attack tariff on German automobiles that are produced in China. So it may have worked to a certain level, but it's not going to be useful in the long run. So we keep telling them that, okay, you supply arms and ammunition to Ukraine. It's very good. We have to defend Ukraine, otherwise it's going to set some very bad precedents for Russia's future ambitions, not just because the Europeans have been not able to read the writing on the wall in 2014 when Russia invaded Crimea. Now they know. Now they are a little more aware, a little more, the understanding of China's role with Russia, just as I was coming from So when the day we left from Czech Republic in Prague, the next day they were holding up the US-Czech accommodation. They are holding a debate or discussion on the future of China-Russia relations, and this bio-dual use technologies and all that. So then the third reason on going for independence is within the Tibetan community. I tell the Tibetan community, if we don't study Tibetan history, who else will? And what will we pass on to the younger generations of Tibetans if we have to struggle for another 30, 40 years down the line? You know, so that is why I encourage young Tibetans to read history, the Chinese version, Western version, Tibetan version, and then create an understanding of Tibetan history in your mind to be able to have a good discourse with others on Tibetan history. And the fourth reason is within the Tibetan community also we have independence advocates, we have the official Middle Way advocates and all that. So my administration, what we are trying to do is to take everybody along. So those who are seeking independence for future also have to prove independence of Tibet in the past. So till we reach the river, we are all on the same path. You know, for Middle Way, we are focusing on history to gain liberation and value for Middle Way. For independence seeker also, they will have to convince governments. It doesn't make sense to argue amongst ourselves. And we have been doing that for so many decades now, you know, since His Holiness talked about this topic. And if there could be a resolution because of our argument within ourselves, then we can speak till our mouth froth, you know, till our throats go dry or till we make the other person deaf, if there could be a solution. But that's not the case. We have to understand these realities. So we have to take all the Tibetans with us, whether it's pro-independence or Middle Way, in that direction. Once we reach the river, we'll see how long it's going to take and what changes and circumstances will prevail in the times to come, because there is a lot of fluidity and dynamism in what's happening. And every single day we have to be very alert about the developments and then see what are the possible opportunities and challenges for Tibet and Tibetan people. So we have to spend a lot of time in working out possible future scenarios for Tibet, for China. And then what would be the possibilities, what would be the opportunities and challenges for Tibet. So these are the lines that we are thinking about. Maybe I'll talk a little bit about the reincarnation, because one senior, very senior US diplomat told me, you don't seem to have a process in place. So I said, that's your perspective. Because our understanding and some of the Indian experts on China, if they can be called experts, because I heard one of the scholars saying, I'm not an expert on China, because nobody can be an expert on China, because the system is so opaque, it's difficult to understand China in that sense, but one can be a China watcher, so there could be, I'm sure there are many China watchers here as well. So, where was I reading? So, yes. Reincarnation issue, the only document that is available on His Holiness reincarnation is the September 2011 document, which talks about when His Holiness reaches the age of 90, he would take certain decisions. Now that's only 7-8 months down the line. By 2025, July 6th will be His Holiness 90th birthday, and we intend to celebrate His Holiness 90th birthday as International Year of Tibet, Year of Compassion. So, to focus on compassion, the message that comes from Indian values, this will be the main focus. So, even now, I keep saying that by 90, if His Holiness feels good, and if His Holiness feels it's not the right time, he might say it's too early, even now. So, I leave all the options open. It's not necessary that His Holiness has to take a decision when he reaches the age of 90. One thing that the Chinese government cannot handle is the unpredictability. Because one time I was going in Thailand and I read a local newspaper and it's reported that the Chinese business people are going to Oracle's to find out what Trump is going to decide next. Because they have no clue of what Trump is going to decide and they can't handle unpredictability. So if His Holiness decides now, because China uses all its international leverage in getting countries from the global south. Now it's a huge competition between India and China on the global south. And China's pivot is towards the global south. But I also question the purchasing power of the global south. And if China floods all these countries with their own capacity, then what's going to happen to all these countries? Just possible industries and medium scale industries are going to die. So it's time to speak about this. So this is where His Holiness might take a decision, may not take a decision. What we are trying to do is the first community that will be impacted by His Holiness reincarnation is the Tibetan Buddhist community. So we are getting every community, Tibetan Buddhist community, to pass resolutions or come out with statements on His Holiness reincarnation, because His Holiness has consistently been saying since 1969 that whether there should be a next Dalai Lama or not will be decided by the Tibetan people. And then going beyond that, then we reach out to the Himalayan Buddhist community or the Mongolians or the Buria, the Tuva, or Kalmyk. So all these countries, Buddhist countries, then you also have the larger the Sanskrit tradition in Korea, in Vietnam, and then also the Pali traditions in Burma, Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, Sri Lanka, and all this. How much we'll be able to reach out to those countries is another matter. But we have also reached out to Buddhist associations in the West, including in UK, in Belgium, in Denmark, in France, in Italy. And I'll be meeting some more for these groups also to come out with statements on His Holiness reincarnation. And now the US is the only government that has a law on reincarnation. So we'll have to work with other countries to see whether other countries will adopt similar lines. I've been pressing on foreign ministries from different countries. Some foreign ministries have language in order, but they want to know exactly where they will need to come out. So these are the efforts that we are trying to make. And when it comes to the process of the selection of the reincarnation, if it is not an emanation appointing someone before one's own demise, then it will be left on the instruction of His Holiness to those whom His Holiness entrusts to carry on this job. And that is where we are right now. So I'll stop here. I know I've taken a lot of time, but hopefully it was useful, and we'll follow through with some more interactive session. Thank you, Chalamet.